I don't know about you, but when I think of inspiring people, my mind doesn't tend to drift toward my inspiring friends like Zoranjali or many of you or to my own life. It tends to drift toward more famous inspirations. People like Nelson Mandela, workers of like historic, well-known change. But this year I had the chance to be a part, actually Zoranji was part of this with me, of a cohort of 15 churches that looked at faith, work, and economics. And this gave me the opportunity to meet quite a few under-the-radar inspirations. People around the country who are finding purpose and finding passion in their daily work and sort of becoming an inspiration. One of them was a public school educator named Nader Twal. And Nader grew up in Saudi Arabia before he moved to this country, to California, as a teenager. And then he looked at quite a few career options, but he ended up becoming a teacher in the city of Long Beach, California. And as a high school teacher of English and of philosophy, he learned some really interesting things. He learned that the functional illiteracy rate in this country, so meaning people that might know how to read technically, they can sound out words, but they can't actually use literacy to do meaningful things in work or with what they read, that the functional illiteracy rate in this country is higher than in many countries in the developed world, and actually higher than many countries in the developing world, including some countries he knew in the Middle East. And he thought, oh, this is what I'm doing. I'm trying to teach literacy to high school students. And in his urban context, he learned that functional illiteracy is actually relatively high in some large urban school systems. And he learned that functional illiteracy is extraordinarily high amongst those that are incarcerated in this country. And so he thought, oh, as I'm teaching literacy and teaching high school English, I'm not just like teaching a subject, I'm actually transforming people's lives, having the opportunity to impact generations through this gaining of literacy. And so Nader taught in Long Beach, and he, with this inspiration, taught so well that he earned some national teaching recognition. And he was so respected in his school system that when a major, and in their context, quite difficult accreditation came along, he was asked to lead the project. And he led that project so well that that took him out of the classroom and into some broader leadership opportunities. Now, in this large urban school district, Nader's job now is to make sure that all the teachers of Long Beach have the tools and the inclination to do excellent work in the classroom. And Nader could continue to be a great classroom teacher. He's a really inspiring, kind of contagious guy. You could tell he's great in the classroom. And I think that's actually what his greatest pleasure in life is. He also could do a lot of other things too, though. He's been a theological school. He sort of did that on the side, and so he could become a pastor. Nader is fluent in Arabic and in English, and so all kinds of people, like the State Department and others, would be happy to have his skills at their disposal. But what Nader knows most is he knows excellent classroom teaching. And his passion is to equip and to inspire educators to do transformative work in the lives of young people. And he thinks that's what Jesus wants him to do in the world. And so he does that as well as he can. On this trip when I met Nader, I met another guy who goes by the name Chef Mike. And he's a chef, as you may have guessed, and he knows food. He lives in California, but he can make amazing deep dish Chicago-style pizza pies. Another thing Mike knows, though, is Mike knows a lot of guys who have spent some time in prison and so have criminal records. And if you have a criminal record, or if any of your friends or relatives do, you may know that it's very difficult to access certain types of employment once you have that record. And so Chef Mike was able to partner with a local church who really cared about the particular community that their building was in, and together they launched a small business called 5,000 Pies. They make great deep dish pizza pies and great sweet dessert pies, and they train and employ folks from their neighborhood who have criminal backgrounds but are trying to get their employment history back on track. And again, Mike could be a chef somewhere else, and this church could spend their energy on some other kind of project or some other location, but they know this neighborhood, and they know the problem of quarries and employability, and they know pies. And so their knowledge became care and became love and became passion, and they're doing this inspiring little thing in their community. I find myself thinking about these people and thinking there are everyday inspirations all around us. And I know there are, as I look around the room, in this room as well. And today I want to ask, how is it that every one of us can be an inspiration, or if we feel like we wear that hat, to keep being an inspiration? And rather than pointing us toward big causes outside of our lives, which there's certainly a time and place for, but rather than pointing us today toward big things beyond the scope of our knowledge, I want to focus in on the things that we already know a lot about and what we can do with those things that we know already. This is our fifth week in a fall series we're going to stick with through Thanksgiving. We've called Inspired, the whole of life with God in the picture. And we're looking around at various corners of real everyday life, and we're asking what difference it makes if we find God there. We're reading these little short stories Jesus called parables that provoke us to imagine what life looks like with God on the scene. And we're reading this ancient but really vivid biography of a woman named Ruth who finds herself trying to start over in her life. And it's to Ruth and to a new character in this story, Boaz, that we're going to turn first today. We'll see what it looks like in their context and some others to live with purpose and passion and to be an everyday inspiration. The excerpt we'll look at first on the inside flap of your program is the longer of the two that are printed there. And just to get you up to speed, Boaz, a guy we'll meet here, is a distant relative of Ruth's mother-in-law, Naomi. And Boaz owns the farm that Ruth stumbles upon, where as a young widow recently arrived in Bethlehem, she's looking for work and looking for food. And here's what happens when this man Boaz sees her working in his field. We read, "Then Boaz asked his foreman, 'Who is that young woman over there? Who does she belong to?'" It's kind of a funny question, unless you're familiar with these kind of cultures. I was talking to a man from Nigeria at a wedding yesterday, and he was saying, "Oh, where I come from, like everyone sort of belongs to a town and to a family, and people ask you where you're from, you share that information." And so that's what Boaz is looking like. Who does she belong to? How is she connected in the world? Here's what the foreman tells him. And the foreman replied, "She is the young woman from Moab who came back from Naomi. She asked, came back with Naomi. She asked me this morning if she could gather grain behind the harvesters. She has been hard at work ever since, except for a few minutes' rest in the shelter." And Boaz went over and said to Ruth, "Listen, my daughter, stay right here with us where you get, when you gather grain. Don't go to any other fields. Stay right behind the young woman working in my field. See which part of the field they are harvesting and then follow them. I've warned the young men not to treat you roughly. When you are thirsty, help yourself to the water they've drawn from the well." Ruth fell at his feet and thanked him warmly. "What have I done to deserve such kindness?" she asked. "I am only a foreigner." "Yes, I know," Boaz replied, "but I also know about everything you have done for your mother-in-law since the death of your husband. I have heard how you left your father and mother and your own land to live here amongst complete strangers. May the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to take refuge, reward you fully for what you have done." "I hope I can continue to please you, sir," she replied. "You have comforted me by speaking so kindly to me, even though I am not one of your workers." At mealtime, Boaz called to her, "Come over here and help yourself to some food. You can dip your bread in the sour wine." So she sat with his harvesters, and Boaz gave her some roasted grain to eat. She ate all she wanted and still had some left over. When Ruth went back to work again, Boaz ordered his young men, "Let her gather grain right among the sheaves without stopping her, and pull out some heads of barley from the bundles and drop them on purpose for her. Let her pick them up and don't give her a hard time." It's a really interesting scene to me. It sounds like Boaz, a little bit of an eye out for Ruth, and indeed he does, and that will develop into different things, but not yet. I think at this point we meet Boaz as essentially a just truly excellent employer. See, Boaz notices who's out harvesting his fields. His foreman is in charge of that part of the operation. His foreman is there to manage the labor, but Boaz still takes an interest in the work and in the workers in his business, and he finds out about this new person on his land. And it turns out she's not a worker technically. She's something called a gleaner. And so last week we talked about how this society had a provision for access to employment and access to food to everyone, regardless of their kind of status or where they grew up in that society or immigrated or whatever. And so Ruth is there picking up the scraps of food, but quite legally, this gleaning, this provision that was there by design behind the paid harvesters. But Boaz, rather than resenting this like extra person picking off his land, or rather than just ignoring her, Boaz talks to her and takes what he knows really seriously. He institutes a sexual harassment policy, right? He doesn't want any of his employees bothering this foreign, single, young woman, and he makes sure they know that. And this is a really remarkable and unusual move in this context that he's in. And then he finds out about Ruth and goes way beyond letting her just glean. He's extraordinarily generous. So he tells her not just to pick up the scraps, but to get right in with the rest of his workers and have access to the best grain. And then he makes sure she's going to have enough. He treats her like one of his longtime employees, making sure she has access to water, access to lunch, access to a break. I think in the end, though, it's not done out of pity. It's done out of honor. Right? He's impressed by Ruth's loyalty, and he's impressed by her character and her work ethic, and he wants to give honor where honor is due. And it's ultimately not charity either, right? Ruth is asked, like, what did I do to deserve this? And he says, in fact, you have deserved this, and he gives her empowerment. Ruth has work, and she has safety, and she has dignity, like none of which immigrant could take for granted in this context. She's starting now to find her own place in this town as a result of this. Boaz isn't any kind of superhero. Right? He's a farmer, and he's a business owner. He knows agriculture, he knows management, and he knows a good person when he sees one. And in this, I think he just takes what he knows, and he cares, and then he acts. At least to me, that results in something really inspiring. And I thought, who else is doing this kind of thing today? And I thought about one person I read about this summer. His name's Hamdi Ulukaya. Some of you are going to like this story. He's the founder of Chobani, the yogurt company. That's a, I know, big hit in a few people's lives. And this guy's got quite a story. He's not much older than me. I think he's 1 year older than me. And in his early 20s, he was growing up in eastern Turkey on his dad's small-time dairy business. But he moved to the States to take some business classes, and he stuck around. He found this little niche as a small-time feta cheese producer. But a number of years ago, he saw an ad that a yogurt processing facility that had gone bankrupt was up for sale. And he thought, this stuff Americans are eating and calling yogurt, this like watery, sugary stuff. He's like, I can do better than that. Like, I know real yogurt. So he consulted a lawyer and he consulted a business advisor, and they both told him, like, do not do this. Like, this is a crazy idea to take out loans to buy this bankrupt facility. But he did it anyway, and he launched his yogurt company. And it popped, right? Like, extremely. He made some really interesting, turns out brilliant, strategic moves. He found a market that no one knew existed, and in less than a decade, his yogurt business went from a nothing to a business that last year had a $700 million infusion of capital to help it grow further. Ulukai has done really well for himself. He is now a billionaire, like all earned in the past, you know, 9 years or something. And I thought, what does Hamdi Ulukaya know? Like, he knows dairy and he knows business. Like, he makes a pretty good product. He knows money now, and he knows generosity, apparently. Since Chobani's inception, they've tithed off their profits. So they've given 10% of their corporate income to good people doing good work in the world, like from day one. It's an awesome financial model. It's one that my family practices as well, that we've learned from others, to give 10% or more of your income to good people doing good work that you care about. And so we do this in our family by giving substantially to this church and by giving in other ways to other people we meet on top of that. And that's been Chobani's practice since their inception. But their founder doesn't just know dairy and business and generosity. Hamdi Ulukaya is a Kurd who's born in eastern Turkey, was an immigrant to this country about 20 years ago. So he knows about Central Asia, and he knows about Kurds, many of whom live in Iraq, and he knows about being really far from your home. And so in the midst of our current world refugee crisis, Ulukaya decided to be another one of those extraordinarily wealthy individuals who would make this giving pledge. Sometimes people call it the Buffett Pledge, after Warren Buffett, who made this agreement famously. And this pledge is to give the majority of one's wealth away during your own lifetime to transform people and communities to good. And Ulukaya thought, I've kind of grown my business about as much as I can. And he hired in other people to manage it, and he's retooled some of his life to be a philanthropist. And Ulukaya this past year pledged to give $700 million to help Kurdish refugees and others impacted by the Syrian refugee crisis. And I think, wow, this is our Long Beach educator, Nader Twal, or Chef Mike and his pie business, just scaled up, like at a whole different volume. So ordinary person taking what he knows and seeing that to know is to have some responsibility, and that to know is to care, is to love. And this is actually a definition of knowledge that this public intellectual and writer I've met, a guy named Steve Garber, he says this is actually what the word knowledge in Hebrew, in the Hebrew Bible, means. I think we hear knowledge and we think of our remarkable brains. We think of all the information we can absorb and all the ways we can process that and make interesting connections. But Garber says this Hebrew word for knowledge, yada, that it's a word that in the Jewish Bible in the Old Testament has such a wide range of uses. So everything from knowing factual information to very relational, very intimate types of knowing. And Garber says the sense of this word in the Hebrew scriptures is that to know is to care, is to love. To know is to be implicated. To know is to have responsibility for what we know. To know is for that knowledge to form a highway for a relationship of caring and of loving in those areas of knowledge. And I think this way of knowing produces an inspiration. None of the people I've talked about so far, Chef Mike or Nader Twal, Hamdi Ulukaya, Boaz of this book of Ruth, none of them had to go very far to find human needs they weren't aware of. None of them had to be superheroes outside of their areas of interest and skill and knowledge. They all already knew stuff, and they all already knew people. And they all decided, or maybe it came intuitively to some of them, but they wedded knowledge with curiosity and with care and with love. They felt with what they knew, and they acted with what they knew. And they really inspire me. I think if you were to talk to any of them, Boaz obviously not being available for conversation, but if you talk to any of the rest of them, I think you'd find that they are inspired by what they're doing, that the passion and purpose they get from caring and loving with what they know makes them both inspired and inspiring. They get to breathe in joy and purpose and passion with what they do. And I expect that's been true at some level for anyone any of us has really admired for their work in the world, that they knew and they cared and they loved in some way, and that made them both inspired and inspiring. And I found myself thinking, like, why don't we all live this way all of the time? And why don't I live this way all of the time? To know and care and love with like boldness and with purpose. Well, I think a big reason, and one that the same author I mentioned, Steve Garber, talks about, is that we're all infected to one degree or another with two other ways of knowing, two very old ways of interacting with our knowledge. And these ways are Stoicism and cynicism. Well, Stoicism and cynicism are ancient Greek schools of thought that predate the time of Jesus, and I have neither the time nor the philosophical chops to do them full justice, so I won't try to do that, but a contemporary Stoic is someone who doesn't care, and a cynic is someone who doesn't bother. The virtue, in fact, that a Stoic would cultivate is the Greek word from which we get our word apathy, because we all know that life is hard, and we can barely manage our own problems, let alone the big problems of a whole world. And so a Stoic learns to tame one's own passions. A Stoic learns to cultivate acceptance, to learn to simply endure instead of change things. A Stoic learns to get less worked up, to cease to care. Stoic would ask, what is Hamdi Ulukaya doing with this whole Syrian refugee crisis? Does he not realize that just throwing money at the problem is not going to help? Or we might ask Chef Mike and his little 5,000 pies business. He employs 5 or 6 people with criminal backgrounds, right? And if he were to scale up his business massively, he could maybe employ 500 people in that situation, and that would still not be a drop in the bucket in our society's sort of employment and incarceration problem. It's the Stoic in all of us that thinks this way, the grown-up in us that learns to stop caring about what we know. But we're not just Stoics, Garber says. Like, on top of that, we're also cynics, most of us. We see people's flaws when we know them, and we don't trust institutions at all. We're too smart, we're too savvy to be idealists. Think of Nader Twal's mission to equip and inspire the educators he worked with. And we think, does he not realize that teachers think their professional development programs are a joke, that they sort of sleep their way through them? Does he not realize, like, old dogs can't learn new tricks, that you have to give up on these people that are not working skillfully? And speaking of dogs, you think of, like, Boaz and his little anti-harassment policy. And think, does he not realize that some people might call men dogs? And like, what are they, you know, think about what they're going to do when he's not around to enforce his policy. It sounds kind of awful, this way of thinking, when I put it into words. But I think that's a lot of the time what happens with people with our big dreams. And I think that's a lot of time what happens with my own hopes and dreams. right? That we learn to be cynical about them, to let them go a little bit. The cynic in us grows up and learns to stop trying to act on what we know because we know it's not going to be good enough. And we don't trust anyone involved, really, ourselves included. Now, this morning, our first service, we had a few more kids in the room. We have some of our kids and teens in the room now. I know some of our middle schoolers were talking about ordinary heroism this weekend on this retreat they were on. I think if you're a younger person in the room, you might hear me talking about grown-ups and think, come on, like, of course when you know about a problem, you're going to care and you're going to try and do something about it, right? But kids, confession, look at this, like, grown-ups forget this. Like, we are not as hopeful as you, and we get tired, and we don't act on the things we care about a lot of the time. And I think, oh, we need some young people in our lives sometimes to, like, rekindle this, to notice this about ourselves. But I think, you know who misses out most when we let our inner stoic and our inner cynic guide us? Right? I think the world around us misses out, but I think we really miss out as well. Last week I mentioned a quotation by this famous 4th century North African theologian and writer, Augustine of Hippo. And I mentioned this quote last week. I'm going to read it again. Augustine has this quote about hope, cynicism, and stoicism. He says, "Hope has two beautiful daughters. Their names are anger and courage. Anger at the way things are, and courage to see that they do not remain as they are." And I thought about this quote and Steve Garber's words. I thought, oh, our inner stoic keeps us from anger. Keeps us from the good kind of anger. So stoicism keeps us from caring. And our inner cynic keeps us from courage. It keeps us from acting, keeps us from any risk. Cynicism stops us from doing anything with our knowledge. And whether we're stoics or cynics, because we're kind of cultivating our image, because naivete, passion, and enthusiasm don't look very cool in our world, or whether we're stoics or cynics because we've failed, or because the odds against what we hope for seem quite high, or because we're just so very afraid, maybe for good reasons. But when that happens, we still miss out. We live without passion, we live without courage, and without hope. When that happens, the world never sees the inspiration we can be, and neither do we. I think, oh, that is such a shame. Jesus, too, thought that what we do with our lives is far more important than what we say. That what we do with our knowledge is far more valuable than how we look at first in our knowing. Jesus once told this little story that gets interpreted in all kinds of interesting and complicated ways, as it should be, because that Jesus was very deep, if nothing else. But it's definitely a story about this topic as well. It's another little workplace tale, this time about a family business. And we have a father and two sons out in this father's vineyard. And it's the second excerpt in your program. Jesus says, "But what do you think about this? A man with two sons told the older boy, 'Son, go out and work in the vineyard today.' And the son answered, 'No, I won't go.' But later he changed his mind and went away. Then the father told the other son, 'You go.' And he said, 'Yes, sir, I will.' But he didn't go. Which of the two obeyed his father?" They replied, "The first." Then Jesus explained his meaning. "I tell you the truth, corrupt tax collectors and prostitutes will get into the kingdom of God before you do. For John the Baptist came and showed you the right way to live, but you didn't believe him, while tax collectors and prostitutes did. And even when you saw this happening, you refused to believe him and repent of your sins." My dad was a contractor when I was growing up. Instead of tending a vineyard, he laid roof and painted houses and built small additions on people's houses north of Boston. It never turned into a father and son business, though, because both of my brothers and I really had no interest in the work that my father did. We were the second son who would tell my dad begrudgingly that we would help him when he asked us, but we'd then find any excuse to stay away from his jobs. Like baseball and video games and TV and stuff always looked far more appealing than picking up nails and roof scraps or digging post holes for foundations. I think our one son in the story is like this. He says he'll act on his father's request, but then he disappears when it's time to do something. The other son is a pill, like an absolute pill. Now again, maybe as a dad, as a teacher, I'm reading into this a little bit, but I feel like the other son is saying, "No, Dad, I'm busy, right? I don't want to. You're annoying and you're mean and stop asking me to do this work." I've heard things like this a few times. I think Jesus says that annoying one, that pill, that's the good kid. Right? In the end, it's the obnoxious kid, the one who says no, who gets out into the vineyard and puts in the work. And Jesus says, that's the good one. Jesus says, not in the words we say or in the image we project that gets us access to kind of what he calls God's country. We find God in the picture. We find God's love and God's power and God's joy. We start to access heaven on earth as we act on what we know. As in our actions, we say yes to Jesus, regardless of who we are or what our first response is. And Jesus goes on to apply this in a controversy in his setting, that he spent so much time around people whose lives had looked like they were saying no to God. So they're violent, extorting collaborators with the Roman occupying force, or people of embarrassing morality and reputations. Jesus made these people his friends, and many of them said yes to Jesus' invitation in their lives. Other people who spoke better, who looked better, did nothing with what they knew, and they're not finding God in the picture, Jesus says. They're not getting God's kingdom on earth. And God says, ultimately, it's not about how we use what we know to work our image. It's not about what we first say or do when Jesus invites us to ask and to act, that it's what we do in the end with what we know. Jesus has used this word repent to talk about this, which means to make a change in direction or make a change in thinking. And we might hear Jesus today inviting us to change our stoic or our cynical ways of thinking, the ways we can get bogged down in apathy and fail to care, or how we can get stuck in distrust or fear or fail to act in courage, how we can say yes to God to do what's most important, but then fail to act. And Jesus, I believe, would say to us today, change your way of thinking. Like, get to work in your vineyard. Step into this land, these spaces where I'm in the picture and all things, and enjoy the life that's to be found for you there. And I want to get a little bit practical with this and get a sense of like how we can say yes to this thing Jesus is asking us to do. And this is where your program notes will pick up, some notes on the screen if you want to follow along that way. That's up to you. But I think our first next step is to listen to and respond for invitations from Jesus, to listen for and respond to invitations from Jesus. If you've been around here for a while, I wonder if that line sounds familiar. It's because it's a line that's straight out of our membership agreement. We're a very open church, and so membership isn't a very formal thing and doesn't involve votes and meetings, but we like to give people an opportunity to be able to say, this is my church, and so we offer a class called 101 a few times a year, and there are actually very few things we ask of our members, but this is one. We say, listen to and respond to invitations from Jesus, because our sense of things is that, like the father in today's story, Jesus is often inviting people to do something important, to try something new, to open up in some way, to be more fully alive and more fully connected to ourselves and others and to God and to this world we live in. And so we say, be on the lookout for that and be ready to respond. Here's the thing, though. Those invitations, they'll most often relate to the people and the things that you know about. These invitations will most often relate to the people and the things that you know most. Or we see Boaz out in the field. He's invited to see, to act, and to honor, and so to be a difference maker in Ruth's life. Last week I talked about that thing we can do that doesn't seem good enough, but it's our best option available to us, and how God sometimes, like a seed we put in the ground, can take the small things we do and birth something really big and wonderful out of it. And I think that's what's happening here through Boaz responding to God's invitation to see and act. I think we can think that if God is going to show up in some big way in our lives and inspire us, it's going to mean quitting our job or becoming some kind of otherworldly heroic person, a person who has access to like more money or more resources than we do, or a person who has a more purposeful or more interesting job than we have, or a person who has a more exciting life than we have. And I think, oh no, but we've seen today God's invitations to us most often come in the context of the people and things we already know. God's invitations to us almost always come in the context of the life we are already living. Like, how will we do our jobs? Not the job we might wish to have or the more interesting job we don't have, but how will we do what we're doing with our time today? How will we use our skills and talents? Again, not the skills and talents we wish we had or that other people that seem more impressive than us have, but the skills and talents we already have, how will we use those? And what will we do with our money? Again, not the $1 billion that Ulukai has that we might wish we had and don't, but whatever little bit we do have. how we respond to that unexpected need we see in our context, in our colleague or in our relative or the person that lives two floors up from us. I think the invitation is that to know is to care is to love. That we can kind of pour into that type of knowing, that we can pour into that knowledge flow, that knowing is caring is loving. I think, again, as I said earlier, I think this is what knowledge really means. It's to care and to love. And by pouring into this kind of knowledge, we know not just with our minds, but with our hearts and with our actions. We become people who inspire others, and ourselves are inspired by doing that. But it's hard to do. It's hard to sort of live that way on a regular basis. So I think we need to do this fourth thing, which is to confess and disrupt our inner stoic and our inner cynic. To confess and disrupt this inner stoic and inner cynic, wherever it is that we lack care or wherever it is that we lack courage. I was talking to someone recently about a problem they had, and they knew exactly what they wanted to do about it. They knew like the best move to make that was going to make this problem better. And they said, I don't have it in me. Like, there's this really good thing I need to do right now, which is going to help my life and some other people's lives so much, and I just don't want to. And they say, you know, I think it's not good enough. I don't really care. I'm not interested in being the better version of myself that would do that thing. And so what they did was they just said that. And it was so refreshing because they were just terribly honest about their lack of inclination to the thing they felt they were supposed to do. And they said, I think I want to pray that God will help me want to do that thing. And Steve, could you pray for me that God would help me do that thing? And it produced an extraordinarily hopeful moment that they know this thing that is going to turn them from sort of stoical, cynical, giving up on this arena of life and doing something really courageous in it. And just in that act of confessing the inner stoic, the inner cynic, it began to disrupt that, right, and change this person's inclinations. Someone else talked to me after first service, and they said, whoa, that thing you just talked about, like, I work with someone who's just, I'm so sick of them, and I'm supposed to mentor this person. I think I'm not interested. And they're stuck with this person for 3 more years, and they literally found themselves saying, this is not like a young person, they found themselves saying, I'll just put up with them for 3 years. They're like, 3 years is a long time. Like, what if there's something more? And they were like, I need to disrupt that. And I said, I think you are, just by confessing that. Like, you're beginning the process of disruption, of changing that way of thinking. Because I think this is the natural flow of life. Like, maybe forever, these are old philosophical schools, but certainly in our times, the natural flow of life is to return to cynicism and return to stoicism again and again and again, to go back to not caring in the context of what we know best, and to go back to not trying in the context of what we know best. But if we can disrupt that cycle through confession, like by naming it, through prayer, and through action, through kind of taking that first step, something quite profound can happen. We can live the lives we are meant to live. And a little way to kind of try this week will be my last tip here, which is to take one risk each day to live with greater purpose and passion. To just try that, one risk each day to live with greater purpose and passion in whatever context you find yourself in each day. I kind of do the homework before I give it every week. Like, I actually kind of try these things in advance usually. And I tried this week. I was like, I don't know, like, what would it mean for me to have greater purpose, greater passion, like right in the middle of things? And I was really not in the mood most of the week. But I found myself with little things, like a text I was going to send anyway. I sort of added on to that text some sort of over-the-top statements of kind of support and love and like, how can I help? And like, that was kind of moving to people. And I thought, oh, this is something. This is a really inspiring way to live. And so I invite you to try it this week, to just once each day think this thought and see how it makes you, almost like despite yourself, an inspiration, and fills you with inspiration. Fills us with how we're meant to live, with this kind of purpose and passion. I think the life that God made us for, that God is inviting us to. So I'm going to close up my part before Chris tells you how you could get prayer if you'd like that, by praying for us all that that would indeed happen for us, that we'd sort of take Jesus up on his invitation for this new way of living this week. So let me pray for you. Pray for us for a minute. Jesus, as I pray, I'm putting you in the face of that vineyard owner for a minute and thinking, I'm glad that you're not interested in sort of leaving us alone and not bothering us. I'm glad that when you see me, kind of my heart kind of gone cold, having less hope or less passion, less courage in my life, that you're like, Steve, come join me. Come get to work. It's going to be great. And my sense is that, Jesus, that's how you're present in the world still, and I'm grateful for that. I'm grateful that you've sort of kept alive and you stir up these everyday inspirations. People I talked about today, I suspect we all know people like that. People whose lives we look at and we think, wow, like how do they do it? They're so inspiring. And Jesus, thank you that that you want to shape a kind of hope and a courage, even an anger, I suppose, in us to give us the chance to live with deep joy and passion and purpose, to live as if we're really a piece of heaven on earth that you want to shape. I pray, Jesus, you would help us to do that. In any ways that feels too big for anyone in the room, give us our small way to live with passion and purpose each day this week. In any ways any of us feel stuck in a discouraged place, in a giving up or not trustful place, I pray you would disrupt that stoicism and cynicism in some way. Yeah, and I pray, Jesus, you would give us the gift of being inspired. Amen.